and welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Joining our host, Jeff Frederick, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, are faculty from the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice. With us are Mario and Judy Poparozzi, Renee Lamphere, and Bob McDonald. Their topic, crime and punishment.
We've all seen it a million times. You tune into your favorite police drama on television, and in 60 minutes or less, the crime of the century has been solved without a shadow of a doubt. Clues magically appear and get put into context immediately. Joe, down at the lab, the municipal government lab that has every modern laser and mass spectrometer ever invented, turns around a footprint in an hour and tells the investigating officer that it was a size 11 shoe manufactured by a boutique firm in England. Three computer keystrokes later, you find the only retailer in the state that carries the footwear. After arriving on the scene and engaging in some witty and flirty banter, an attractive young manager unearths the credit card receipt that shows just who bought the size 11s and when. Speeding off to find the suspect in his 8,000-square-foot New York apartment. I mean, how unbelievable is that? The detectives use their cunning to soon extract a confession, and then a couple of right crosses later to prevent an escape. The suspect is soon cuffed and booked and hauled off to the station, where more witty banter ensues, often in front of a perpetually angry captain who complains about one thing or another before throwing the detectives out of his office. Later, they reconvene at the local bar and throw down a couple of brews, all while reminiscing over solved cases like a little leaguer remembering his first home run. Undoubtedly, there's much more to it. The art, craft, and most importantly, the science of criminology, a field related to criminal justice, but not a synonym, doesn't ever seem to come across on television or film. Neither does the amount of time required to solve a case. Suspects don't always confess, and most lawyers never have a Perry Mason moment. But people do, however, go to jail. Over 2.3 million are currently incarcerated, and as many as 11 million come in and out of a jail each year. About 20% or more of arrests are for drug-related offenses. When folks get out, many end up going right back in for one reason or another. The United States has less than 5% of the world's total population, but over 20% of the globe's prisoners. Why is this? How does the law enforcement community actually solve crime? Do prisons work? Why do we have so many people, over 4 million, on probation and parole? These and other questions today. Our topic is crime and punishment. Our guests, Dr. Mario and Judy Poparozzi, Renee Lamphere, and Bob McDonald. So let's start with a softball. What does TV get right, if anything, and what does it get wrong about law enforcement and the criminal justice system?
Wow, what a great question. By the way, if they put what really happens in crime and justice on the street on television, there'd be a lot of dead air. No one would watch. I mean, things happen so quickly on those TV shows, and people have such a skewed opinion about how crimes are committed and by whom and how they're solved and so on. I loved your introduction. Frankly, I mean, it just doesn't happen that way in real life. But I do love watching Law & Order. I watch it every night before I go to sleep. And I sit there and often, along with Judy, say, you can't do that. They don't do this. And the prosecutors and the interrogators are doing things that they're not allowed to do to elicit confessions that they shouldn't have gotten in the first place, and so on. All I can say, I guess, in short, is that what we watch on TV, Forensic File, NCIS programs, it's just not an accurate depiction of reality. And this business of criminal profiling, my goodness, you know, if you watch these criminal profiling shows, you'd think it's a really hard science, and it's just not.
One of the most basic things that they get wrong on television is that they think Miranda has to be given upon arrest. And that's such a mistake, because if you're arrested drunk, what's the use of doing Miranda warnings? This is a good example of what you mentioned at the beginning. The Miranda warning is only given when there's custodial interrogation, so you're in custody and you're being interrogated. And I have to teach my students every semester, no, it's not like TV, it's more like this. And, you know, the Supreme Court decision on this, which is Miranda versus Arizona.
I think another thing, I can tell from my own personal experience as 27 years as a criminal investigator that I know that you don't get the lab results back in an hour.
Did you say a year?
Yeah, sometimes a year, depending on the priority of the case, depending on the type of evidence, something like a footprint or even DNA, the labs are so backed up with other requests and other priorities. So it wouldn't be unusual for me to send in a lab request and have to wait 6 months before I actually got the results. In the meantime, you still have to work the case. You have to follow the leads. You have to do the interviews, do the interrogations. Another impact, let me just mention this too, is this CSI effect, this forensic belief by the public that you do get this turnaround so quick. And it does have a negative impact on juries now, because juries expect that every case that goes to trial, they're going to see forensic evidence, they're going to see DNA evidence, they're going to see all these scientific techniques being put to play in every case that occurs, and that's not reality, because you're not going to get it every time.
A lot of jurors who hated science in high school and college suddenly have become experts.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, that's exactly correct, and this is something that prosecutors have to deal with, because they have to try to overcome that expectation, which is false. And, of course, some cases do have DNA. It'd be wonderful if every case had a DNA, and you can link somebody to a fingerprint or something like that, but it just doesn't happen that way. And unfortunately, this is something that the criminal justice system has learned to deal with, and this is one of the negative impacts of television and CSI and forensic science.
Sadly, rape kits seem to be the one piece of evidence that are most delayed in our system, as much as 2 years in many states. Very sad about that.
I, too, am a big Law & Order fan, especially SVU. I love Olivia Benson. She is one of my favorite characters of all time. Something that I notice and I talk about in class with shows like Law & Order is that oftentimes they'll have the position of detective, and they're doing like 7-8 jobs that would be available in the criminal justice system. It also, one of my pet peeves is when there's a suspect running down the street and they just fire their gun, all willy-nilly at anybody. And a police officer is responsible for every single bullet that's issued to them. And so if you're going to shoot a bullet out of your gun, that's going to come with a stack of paperwork. So there's no doing that. But a show that I like, not law enforcement, but Orange is the New Black, the show about women's prisons that came out on Netflix last year. I think it's an interesting show, and it does depict some aspects of the correction system that are correct. Like, it talks about the pseudo families that women form. It talks about how racial and ethnic minorities tend to group together while they're incarcerated. But then they really lose the storyline when they have like a wild chicken that's running through the prison that they're all trying to capture. So I applaud any new attempt that tries to show the correction system, but I think that sometimes it almost glamorizes it. And as somebody who spent a lot of time studying corrections and jails and prisons, I can tell you that there's nothing glamorous about it.
Well, we'll come back and pick that up in a minute, but before we get them incarcerated, we have to solve the case in some sense. So talk about how it actually does work. How do cases get solved, or do they? Do a significant percentage of crimes get caught?
Well, that's a good question. If you just look at statistical numbers, violent crimes have the highest resolution rates relative to what we call clearance rates, and that's where either a case results in an arrest, an investigation results in an arrest, or in some manner an individual can be connected to the crime. Maybe they're a serial rapist, and they get arrested for one rape, and then we can connect them to 29 other rapes. As you move down from violent crime into property crimes, you see a much less percentage of cases that are solved, simply because just the sheer numbers of crimes that are reported. Larceny is the number one crime in the United States, and that can be anything from pickpockets to somebody stealing somebody's books, in their dorm room or in the campus there. And because of the sheer number of it, there's not enough investigators, there's not enough police to be able to give the adequate attention that you would have to provide to try to get a solution rate of 100%.
However, I would disagree on only one thing, not with Bob, but in terms of narcotics, and I was a narcotics prosecutor, the investigation is there, the political will is there to have narcotics investigated. So we're getting everything from street dealers all the way up to kings of these these networks, of these drug networks. So Bob's right. Homicide, rape, any kind of kidnapping is going to be a high priority for any police department. But narcotics seems to be the one other crime outside of the violent crime that is going to be prosecuted. And we do catch a fair number of them because, honestly, they're right out in front of us most of the time.
That depends on where you are as well. If you're in a major city, Charlotte, New York City, whatever. But car break-ins, for example, in New York City just ain't no big deal. I had my car broken into one night years ago in New York City, and I called the emergency box on the pole, and I happily waited on the corner, and here down the street comes a police car after about 15 minutes with two cops in it. They didn't even get out of the car, and they said, here's a number to call tomorrow for your incident report. And I said, aren't you going to get out and dust the car for prints and so on? And they said, well, there are so many of these every night, you know, there's not much we can do about it and so on. Never got out of the car.
But that goes to my point about political will, though, because Rudy Giuliani, when he became mayor of New York City, what did he do, Mario?
He did exactly that. He took the small-level crimes under right. that theory that we all know, we all talk about, right, broken windows theory, where he said if you solve these small problems, these problems of disorder, low-level crimes and things that aren't even crimes, if they're just disorderly, then you probably could lay a foundation for a healthier community that doesn't breed as much crime, in essence.
Let's go back to something Renee introduced a little bit ago. Let's talk about our prison system. Are we in the punishment business? Are we in the rehabilitation business?
Should we be or are we?
Yes.
Well, I started working in prisons in 1972 in New Mexico, and I worked in the prison of New Mexico that had the worst riot in the history of the United States. 33 inmates were killed. 12 hostages were taken, all brutalized, but all lived. Believe it or not, that prison did the best rehabilitation programs I have ever seen before the riot. 4 years before the riot, all the rehabilitation programs were pulled. At the same time, wonderful victims advocates like John Walsh were appearing on the scene. If you don't know who John Walsh is, he's the father of Adam Walsh, who was killed in Florida, and John Walsh was Mr. America's Most Wanted, we saw for years. Mario and I luckily became very involved in the prison system, but then the prison system went from rehabilitation to totally just desserts and punishment, which Mario can talk about, I'm sure Renee as well. And then I don't think the pendulum has swung back to where any focus is on rehabilitation. Now, I worked in three different states. I was a teacher in a prison in Pennsylvania, and I worked for the parole board in New Jersey, spent almost 15 years in prisons, locked up, and I never saw what I saw in the early 70s, post-Attica and post the terrible Arkansas discoveries, the prisons there. So I've never seen the pendulum swing back. When I visited Scotland Correctional Institution, the classrooms were tinier than the room we're in today, just very little. There wasn't a focus on education, which I think is a major key to rehabilitation. And the big area was the sewing room, the tailor shop, filled with men. How many? They're not Italian tailors either, like we would see in Italy. But I saw that when I talked to the corrections officer leading us around and giving the tour, rehabilitation programs were below the kitchen detail and the license plate making and so forth. And it broke my heart after being in the system for 30 years. It broke my heart to see that.
Just one correction. We are currently in the palatial 30 Brave Minute studios. They're not actually small.
I think that when you're talking about rehabilitation in the correction system, that you can't ever really get too far removed from public opinion and how that influences it. I think if you're talking about an individual, say you have a brother or a cousin or somebody who's incarcerated, you individually want that person to be rehabilitated. But when you're talking about criminals as a group, I think it's the general public just doesn't care about rehabilitation. When it comes down to, do I want my money spent on education for my children on school books, or do I want my money spent on rehabilitating inmates? People are going to pick their children in school books. We're definitely in the business of punishment in this country. I think the only silver lining that I see is that there has been a push towards evidence-based programming and evidence-based research in the field of criminal justice and criminology, especially within the past 10 years. And I think if anything is going to push us into that rehabilitation era again, I think it's going to be evidence-based policies.
Renee, I think, made a critical point that I would like anybody who listens to this podcast to hear and understand. And I think this way about it. I worked for 30 years in a Department of Corrections, and I learned after 29 years that we're not in, we shouldn't market our goal to the American public as being rehabilitation. Rehabilitation is a means to an end, and that end is public safety. And a lot of people don't like rehabbing bad guys, and some people don't mind rehabbing bad guys. But we can set that all aside if we understand that the end game is public safety. And if the research evidence tells us that the absolute best way to get the most public safety from this very difficult criminogenic population would be to rehabilitate them, even if we don't like to do that, we must do it or else we're negligent. And that's the important point here, and I think that a lot of people who work in the business don't even understand that. If I talk to a group of senior people in departments of corrections and say, what are we in business to do? And somebody might say rehabilitation, rarely, but they might anymore, but they might say that. That isn't a good goal to market to the people. But everybody wants to be safe. And if the preferred way to be safe based on research is to provide rehabilitative services, evidence-based practices, you must do it. And I would like that dialogue to shift because liberals and conservatives can come together on that issue.
Let me just follow up on that real briefly. If the goal was public safety and the means to reaching that goal was rehabilitation, would we know how to rehabilitate prisoners? Do we have enough information to be successful at it, assuming we had the will?
Well, when I worked in the prison in New Mexico that I just mentioned, the case of Furman v. Georgia had just been decided in 1971, and I started in 1972. So I went to college with about 10 men and women who had been on death row. Now, that's the ultimate punishment that we give in this country. But my college, which was in Santa Fe, stepped in. Do you know not one of those inmates, they all graduated from college, they were number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 in their classes, each in their respective classes, not one ever went back to prison, and yet they'd been on death row and they were repeat offenders. So I found early on that nothing can empower an individual like an education and a job. The counseling programs I saw in the many prisons I worked in, which includes Rahway State Prison, Trenton State Prison, prisons in Pennsylvania and New Mexico, as I mentioned, I saw in Pennsylvania, but I didn't see in New Jersey the focus on education that I saw, luckily, in earlier in my career. So I do believe you can rehabilitate people because I began my career seeing the absolute benefits of education and good counseling, I had counseling as rehabilitative means to an end, as you mentioned.
You know, I've arrested repeat offenders before, people that have been in prison and come out. And I always used to ask them that question. I'd always ask them, hey, you know, what are you doing back here? You know, we investigated you 5 years ago. You went off for 4 or 5 years. And the answer invariably would hit on what you're saying. They just took me and dumped me back in the neighborhood with no resources, no education, no job training, and really no hope. And I had no way to put food on the table, so I went right back to what I was doing, whether it was selling drugs or robbing liquor stores. Mm-hmm. And it was very frustrating for us as criminal investigators because, you know, there's our time having to reinvestigate somebody that's already been to prison, and hopefully if the system would have been better, maybe we wouldn't have had to, we could have moved on to more important.
And it's important to note, these anecdotes are nationally out, they're all over the country. I mean, these are not just little stories that we happen to know. You can go anywhere in the country, and I pretty much have, and you hear the same stories over and over again about what we're not doing in the prison. But Renee, you had some.
I think rehabilitation, I think to a certain extent, you have to have a willing offender. You have to have somebody that wants to be rehabilitated. I don't think that you can force that on somebody. You can put somebody in the best evidence-based treatment program possible. And if there's a part of them that doesn't want to get better, doesn't want to be rehabilitated, I think you're going to be hard-pressed to actually rehabilitate somebody. But I'd not to harp on the same point, but what Bob said, when you take somebody and you give them treatment, you give them programs, and then you put them back into the same neighborhood, the same conditions and living environment that they came from, I don't see how you expect them to do anything but fail, and I think we set people up for failure. It's very easy to get lost in the criminal justice system.
Absolutely.
It's like a meat grinder.
And once inside, It's almost there's almost no way out of it. That's the scary part. So I always believe, you know, not only was I a prosecutor, I was a public defender for a long time as well. The key with me was I would talk to my cops, can we keep this person out of the criminal justice system? Because you're going to do more harm than good. And how many parents came to me and said, I want my kid to learn a lesson? I said, well, then teach it to them. Don't make my officers teach it to them. Because once inside, they're, like Renee said, they're ensnared. And breaking from that, breaking from a prior record is almost impossible.
And just to note, the great state that we're in, North Carolina, is one of two states where you automatically go to the adult court system at age 16. North Carolina and New York.
Yep.
That's great.
I'd be remiss while we were talking about prisons to not throw this out there. What does the data show about private prisons or corporate-owned prisons? Do they work? Are they punishment side, rehabilitation side? Is it just a profit center? Talk about that for a minute.
By the way, I did a lot of work in Tennessee for Governor Bredesen a few years ago, and they have private prisons out there. You know, I worked in a state prison system, and we privatized some services, not our prisons. We wrote the specs. We weren't doing a very good job. So we wrote specs for the private sector to do the kind of job we were doing, but cheaper. Mm. So my observation is that they are neither more nor less effective. They pay less money, so they have higher staff turnover. That could be a good or bad thing, given some of the staff that I've seen over the years. Right. But I really don't think there's you could say that private prisons in general are producing a better or a worse result. I think they're producing about the same result, because the people who are contracting with them wrote the specifications, and they weren't very good in the first place.
And there's another point, too, that dovetails with what Mario was saying and what Bob said before. When you have a big case blow up of an ex-offender going out and shooting 10 people or whatever, back to that word political, the words political will. The political will completely changes, and we become a system of warehousing. And it just because the state prison does it, you think the private prison won't. But the private prison also wants no escapees. So they've trained their officers, and a lot of people who work in corrections didn't have any background in criminal justice or criminology. They train their officers to be the goon squads that go in, and you know, they can know how to extract somebody from the cell. And so they become specialists only at one thing, which is warehousing.
People without backgrounds in corrections, we just referenced that. You know what I always say in a lot of the talks that I give? If you can hire the top person, the director of corrections, the secretary of corrections, commissioner of corrections, whatever you call them, depending on the state, politically, based on their political credentials, then you can do anything you want below that. And too often, and these jobs are political appointees without backgrounds, they then run the system based upon their favorite flavor of the year and not on the research evidence. And so the political nature of the system has really conflicted and impeded the professionalization of what we would like to accomplish in our prisons and jails.
And Joe DiMaggio was a New York State parole board member.
Yeah, can you imagine?
Well qualified.
We'll return to 30 Brave Minutes in a moment, but first, thank you for listening and for your financial support of the College of Arts and Sciences. Please consider a contribution to the Arts and Sciences Dean's Fund. The fund exists to help students and faculty make meaningful connections to the community, the state, and beyond through intellectual inquiry, scholarships, and research in the humanities, social sciences, and STEM fields. Consider a contribution today. Mark your envelope to Dean's Fund, College of Arts and Sciences, UNCP, Hickory Hall, Pembroke, North Carolina, 28372, or call the College of Arts and Sciences at 910-521-6198. You can also find us on the web. And now, back to 30 Brave Minutes and your host, Jeff Frederick.
Let's see if we can turn the glass of water half full. Most of the crime statistics for the last decade or so are relatively optimistic. Is there good reason that Americans should feel reasonably safe in their daily life?
crime statistics in my almost 50 years now go up and down on their own. I really don't know why. And it's not a function of incarcerating more or incarcerating less. I think it has something to do with a whole bunch of other societal factors, an employment situation, social assistance programs, culture, et cetera, et cetera. But, yeah, we should feel better that the crime rates have gone down. But, frankly, I think it's also a function that we're counting things a little differently and so on. There are still many unsafe parts of New York City in spite of Mayor Giuliani's commentary to the contrary.
Could also be an effect of the model penal code was used by states around the country, I'd say in the late 70s, early 80s, to have truth in sentencing. And so a lot of parole was eliminated eventually. A lot of parole release was eliminated. So we're seeing people locked up for a longer period of time, which also may be one of those factors, like Mario said, that affect what we're seeing nationally in statistics.
I would agree with that. And I also think we've seen an increase in the professionalism in the criminal justice profession itself. I mean, just our school here, we put out a lot of criminal justice graduates, and a lot of them are going into local, state, and even federal law enforcement. And getting a higher educated candidate into the system, I think, bodes well for the future, just because they're better educated, they're more dedicated, they're more motivated, and really the money hasn't gotten any better, so they're really fortunate. And I think that, along with the things that you two just mentioned, also has had a positive impact on bringing that crime rate down, a downward trend over the last, say, 20 years.
Probation officers are historically way overworked in terms of their caseload, in terms of their responsibilities. How could we make probation officers more successful in the things that they do once someone has been released from not even prison but from jail for a relatively minor offense?
Hire our graduates. No, I'm serious. Because, by the way, because of people like Renee, myself, Judy, Bob, and others who have worked in the field and also have a strong scholarly background, I know that our students are getting a different flavor when they take our classes. They're not just learning about what a system looks like, how it functions, and so on. And I think they're going out there with a broader perspective about things. And again, if they can't like offenders, then they need to get another career or act as if they like them, right? That's what a probation officer needs to do, or else you can't work for me. And I think they're hearing that message in a lot of our classes. And frankly, I think that's why they're so successful, in particular in probation parole. I mean, we have a load of graduates working in probation and parole in this state. They're well-liked, well-thought-of. I talk to the chiefs and so on.
Well, that's great input. Let me give you all a tremendous amount of power. You have the ability to step in and make a major alteration to one element of the criminal justice system. And the goal is to get the most success in the overall series of problems that combine for where we're at. What would you do? Why would it work?
Plea bargaining. I hate it. I don't, if you talk to anybody and say, if we don't do plea bargaining, the system will come to a halt. Well, we're not in business for a system to go forward or come to a halt. We're in business to seek justice. And when you lord over somebody's head that you're going to go to jail for a gazillion years unless you cop a plea to this lesser offense for 10 years, and you don't have any money for an attorney other than a public defender, no offense, but they're not as good as F. Lee Bailey, and so on. A lot of people cop pleas that they shouldn't be copping. That's number one. On the flip side, victims are wondering, why did he go to jail for robbery when he really raped me, hit me in the head with a hammer, et cetera, et cetera? But victims of crimes are misled by district attorneys all the time because district attorneys like to win, and public defenders like to win. We have a system based on winning and losing. So they play let's make a deal, and somebody can win a notch on their belt for I won the case or I lost the case. That's not a just system. And this business of you have a right to an attorney, well, if somebody I loved got in trouble, the first thing I would be doing was be hiring the best attorney that money can buy, not the one that the state would provide for me that has 1,000 cases and can't even remember your name in an hour after he meets you.
So Mario just got rid of plea bargaining. What about the rest of y'all?
if I could wave my criminal justice wand, I would make sure that policies were enacted based on things like data and not public fears and public opinion. There are so many things that we do. We talk about in my classes, we'll talk about the DARE program. And DARE makes everybody feel so good on the outside. But what does the research tell us about DARE, the Drug Abuse Resistance Education Program? It tells us that it's not working. There are some studies that indicate that DARE is actually the first time that many people are introduced to drugs. And there are some studies that show that it has an aggravating effect. It almost makes drug use worse. But do you want to be the politician that goes through your jurisdiction saying, I'm going to end the DARE program if you elect me? That's just one example of so many programs and policies that we implement that are based on public opinion and public fear. And it doesn't, I was just looking at the 2015, the Uniform Crime Report this morning when I was getting ready for the podcast. And, our property crimes, this is the 10th year of decline that we've seen. They saw a slight increase in violent crime rates this year compared to 2014. But again, like Mario said, that usually shakes out within a year or two. But, if you ask somebody like my grandma, she'll tell you that crime's at an all-time high, that kids are crazy, that the world's going to end. And I think that the general public doesn't have an understanding of crime like criminologists do. So I just wish that policy was based on more criminological aspects as opposed to public fears.
Renee, you bring up an excellent point. I think the media has a lot to do with that, with the sensationalization of cases. They'll take cases, and the way they sensationalize them, you think that violent crime was just rampant everywhere, and you're right, the facts are not the same. If I was going to add something, I'd like to see some tort reform. The appellate processes can be very frustrating, where so many individuals have so many levels of appeal that sometimes these appeals go on for years and years and years. And whether you agree with the death penalty or not, a person can sit, what's the average, 14 years on death row, I believe.
Well, in Arkansas, actually last night executed two people, yeah. One of which had been on death row for 22 years.
Yeah.
They were executed on the same gurney. I read that this morning. That's how eager they were to execute them, that they used
the same gurney.
The same gurney.
Wow, that's kind of bizarre, but I'm just talking about the actual appeal process itself.
It seems to me,
yeah, if they could streamline the system, I think that would be beneficial and also cost-effective.
Judy?
Well, since Mario has attacked lawyers through plea bargaining, he attacked lawyers through the appellate division. I'm not going to defend lawyers because I agree with them both, except for about plea bargaining. I worked in every aspect of the criminal justice system. I was blessed to be in all parts of it, law enforcement as a prosecutor, worked in municipal courts as a prosecutor, and then the prison system as well as probation and parole. And I would say, once somebody's in the system, like I said before, we have to focus on what happens to them while they're incarcerated. And like Renee mentioned, which I love, we've got to base our programming on what works. And I'm sure you've all heard that term here as well. But I have seen education work. And as a professor, as an adjunct professor here, I see education working every day and lives being changed, people being empowered. So I think I would focus my attention on putting educational programs inside of every prison in the country, and it would have to be not mandatory, but you'd have to earn the right into it, because no one wants to do something that's mandatory. Nobody wants to do something that's a gift. But if you have to earn your right into a school and stay in that school because you're doing well, you're learning lessons that you're never going to learn anywhere else. Mom's going to be nice to you, dad's going to whatever. So I really believe that's what I would change. Not plea bargaining.
And the last word goes to Judy. Thanks for a really lively and fascinating discussion. I think we covered a lot of ground, and I appreciate all of your different perspectives. Many thanks to the panel. Thanks to all of you for listening. If you like what you're listening to, pass it on to a friend. See you next time on 30 Brave Minutes.
I want a rematch.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or Indian industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves!